The Partially Examined Life depends on your support. To find out how to do that in ways that are cheap or even free, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/support.
Welcome to the Partially Examined Life, episode 145, part 2, on Emmanuel Levinas, mostly talking about the essay Ethics as First Philosophy, but we're going to get more into time and the other. So we had in the first half gotten at the history of philosophy, according to him, is all about knowledge, and knowledge is domination, and maybe in the idea that whenever we have an explicit perception of something, there's always a background implicit notion of self going on. It's the thing that is at least unifying the experience, and that non-intentional, non-positional knowledge, maybe that's a model for something that we could use. So now we were getting into how this relates to ethics, how this relates to others. So have we moved to section 4 here, or are we still finishing off 3?
I think we want to finish off 3. We get this image of pre-reflective, non-intentional consciousness as this passivity that's dominated by the other side, by intentional consciousness, which is, again, reminiscent of the Hegelian master-slave dynamic. And then we get the kind of what follows from that. This bad conscience is not the finitude of existence signaled by anguish. My death, which is always going to be premature, does perhaps put a check on being, which qua being perseveres in being, but in anguish this scandal fails to shake the good conscience of being, or the morality founded upon the inalienable right of the conitus, which is always the right and the good conscience of freedom.
Say what the conitus is.
That's the Spinozan way of putting it.
It's the self-motivation, self-willing. It's sort of the energy, the propulsion.
You sort of get this objectifying, willing part, which dominates this passive, pre-reflective part.
However, it is in the passivity of the non-intentional, in the way that it is spontaneous and precedes the formulation of any metaphysical ideas on the subject, that the very justice of the position within being is questioned, a position which asserts itself with intentional thought, knowledge, and a grasp of the here and now. In other words, the position is when we're exerting ourselves as conscious beings with egos and really making any claim at all, even if it's just this book is in front of me. Well, there's the me that's there, and it's me being in front of the book. I'm sort of dominating the landscape. In I'm the subject of the sentence. And he says, even is my position as the perceiver of the book justified? Why is that even a question? Well, he says it's actually part of the experience still. There's always a non-intentional, really it's the perception it's of the horizon, which is not a perception at all. That's a misleading way of putting it. It's the stuff that's not part of the, how do you put this? That's not part of the intentional content. And if you say it's the horizon, that's part of the perception, that still sounds like you're asserting yourself aggressively.
I'm not sure what you're asking exactly.
The passivity of the non-intentional, the way that is spontaneous and precedes the formulation of any metaphysical ideas, when we're actually looking at our experiences, is it that some of our experiences involve this passivity and some of them are active assertions of self? Or is it that even in an active assertion of self, there's an element of passivity that's sort of there as a background feature? So it's always there to refer to. That's what I'm trying to figure out. Does it matter?
No, I think it does matter. Let me edit that sentence you were reading. It is in the passivity of the non-intentional that the very justice of the position within being is questioned, a position which asserts itself with intentional thought, knowledge, and a grasp of the here and now. I think what he's trying to get at is passivity is an invitation. It does not assert. It does not strive. It does not exert its right to be. It's the bunny, right? It's the bunny in the field. And the invitation is to make a judgment about whether you think that thing has a right to exist or whether you want to treat it a certain way. It doesn't act to provoke any kind of response. It's simply the fact of its existence, the fact of its duration that invites you to make a judgment about that.
Well, another way of putting it is that the fact that non-intentional consciousness sort of lives alongside intentional consciousness leads us to question the justice of intentional consciousness.
I was just trying to get at what the alongside means, but it sounds like from what Seth was just saying that it is a part of the very same experience. Yeah. Just the fact that there's temporality at all. Temporality is always passive on our part. We're being subjected to
it. But why does it call it into question? I think it calls it into question because the illusion of good conscience is that all we are is this positive part. All we are is this objectifying masters of nature and so on and so forth. But if this persists, even in our intentional thought, that has to be an illusion. It can't be entirely right.
So you might say bad conscience in the way he's using it is a reminder of bad faith in Sartre's sense.
I thought of the sophist a lot in this because it's a reminder that the things that we think we know and the things that seem to be knowledge that are almost most compelling as knowledge are in a way most open to question. For Plato, it was knowingness. It was sort of the conceit of knowing things that you don't really know. There's always the sense of that kind of overreach, you know, in knowledge, right? So we think of the Socratic dictum. I know only that I don't know. Do the sorts of things that involve us in mastery of the world, is that knowledge in the true sense that we mean knowledge? Well, it's certainly not ethical knowledge. I think maybe there's a hint that ethical knowledge can't be modeled on that type of knowledge. We have to look to this passive part.
Well, I like the way you put that because then even the idea, like I was talking about before, where if you perceive a book, then you transcendently perceive, you perceive it as a transcendent, as possessed of all these possibilities. But in a sense, it seems like it's a finite set of possibilities. And so there's the illusion whenever you have a concrete perception that you are kind of master of the possibilities and master of the future, right? That nothing fundamentally surprising could happen. And that's an illusion. That's thinking that you know something that you really don't.
The illusion might be sort of discounting the sense in which we are active participants instead of, you know, and again, I think of de Beauvoir here. We transform things into the serious. So this kind of gets us at the ethical level. We take those things as sort of objects to be known in nature as opposed to be things that we assert with our freedom. But I don't know if that's actually relevant because he's associating freedom with good conscience. In a way, this is a challenge to the typical existentialist reliance on freedom, I think, for its ethical bearings. We go deeper in that into this passive part.
In that we feel like when we're asserting the traditional aggressive notions of knowledge that we feel that we're being free there, but we're actually ignoring the passive element, which is really going to come to be a call to responsibility. Mm-hmm. So we think we have this freedom that we're just Nietzschean Übermenschen. But no, we're actually subject to very strict ethical, well, maybe not specific ethical laws, but like a definite call that
laws.
So yeah, we're for Sartre and de Beauvoir. Our ethical comportment to others in a way is a matter of our own freedom. It comes from us. I think for Levinas, it's going to come from the other. It's going to be this fundamental demand made by the other that we are passive before, that we have no choice in a way. Obviously, we have a choice because we can be unethical, but at some more fundamental level, we are just subject to it, to that demand.
There's a section in one of the other essays about freedom where he suggests that if you look for freedom in the other, I'm trying to think of how he phrased it, something to the effect of freedom will create a struggle for domination.
That's in the Eros section of Time of the Other, which is a great section. I think the point there is our confrontation with the other is not, as in Hegel, it's not a positing of the other as a freedom, because then you get the master-slave struggle. They're both free entities in the struggle. It's a positing of the other as mystery, which he identifies with the feminine and modesty.
Okay. Yeah, I found the part. So if we need to go back to that, I can.
Okay.
So now we're in section four. One has to respond to one's right to be, not by referring to some abstract and anonymous law or judicial entity, but because of one's fear for the other. My being in the world, or my place in the sun, my being at home, have these not also been usurpation of spaces belonging to the other man, whom I have already oppressed or starved, or driven out into a third world? Are they not acts repulsing, excluding, exiling, stripping, killing? Pascal's My Place in the Sun marks the beginning of the image of the usurpation of the whole earth, a fear for all the violence and murder my existing might generate in spite of its conscious and intentional innocence. So there you go. So why is this not just alarmist. How does this in any way follow from the fact that we have non-positional self-consciousness, the fact that we are passively subject to time? I think maybe it doesn't follow from those things. I think those are supposed to be just comparisons to, oh, we're passive in those respects. We're also passive with regard to the other, that we just phenomenologically, he thinks, hey, look at your experience. You will see, it's how phenomenology has to work, right? Is you look at your experience, honestly, you will see that you have an immense fear for the other as like a fundamental thing.
Yep. And fear of what our being could do to the other in the kind of nasty, brutish, and short Hobbesian version of things, which is where it all starts. So yeah, I think that's a legitimate fear, but it's a way of getting us to this idea that at a very, very low level, you know, and if we are thinking of this developmentally, kind of morality is built at this very low level into the structure of consciousness because I am constituted through other consciousnesses, and that already is an ethical problem.
I'm just not sure how to confirm or deny this intuition. It seems, in fact, that it's a rather sophisticated thought that my very being could be racing or impinging on the being of someone else. It seems like that's not something, for instance, that little children worry about. It might be that, yes, we are built in such that if somebody gets injured in front of us, we'll go, oh my gosh, we'll have some sort of, whether it's a sympathetic or he wants to say it's not sympathetic because in fact, the other is remaining other. It's not that we're, by be sympathetic, that sounds like I'm putting myself in their shoes. And he specifically says that's not what this is. But you could say that we primordially react. Other people kind of look at us and expect things. And that is a primary driver of motivation beyond just about anything else. It's even more so than food and other sort of internal things.
Right. We are instinctual beings. And at some point developmentally, we put the brakes on those instincts. We don't just act on them. Can't just do everything we want. When we're a toddler, we might try and punch someone every time we get frustrated, but that gets curtailed and it's internalized. It's not just because you're not going to get a cookie. So we recognize this demand that's made by the other. You know, I intuitively understand what Levinas is saying. Would someone like Sartre deny this psychological development, mental level? Isn't it consistent with his philosophy? I'd have to think more about that. What does this mean ontologically? It's kind of clear what it means psychologically. But what could it mean on this, if ontology is the right word, but we are using it as first philosophy here, according to Levinas. But.
And he's saying it's a fear. It's a real fear. It reaches back past my so-called self-consciousness in spite of whatever moves are made towards a good conscience by a pure perseverance in being. It is the fear of occupying someone else's place within the da of my Dasein. In other words, the there of my there being. It is the inability to occupy a place. A profound utopia.
Because utopia is literally no place. Utopia. Yeah.
So what do you think, Seth? Is this a fundamental fear that you have? Or how could you even figure out whether you have such a fear?
Well, let me say two things. One is, I think the term fear here, we want to interpret it psychologically. But if we're going to take seriously what he says, we don't appeal to abstract anonymous law or some sort of third party. But he's trying to say fear, he means that it comes from within. It's not an appeal to something external that we have to conceptualize or rationalize. I think what he's trying to say is the very fact of this being called to account for your existence generates a response, which is not itself a rational response. And so that's what you're supposed to. And I think in one of the other essays, he uses the term immanent, talks about immanence versus transcendence. So I think that's one thing to consider. The other thing to consider is think about fair trade. You guys ever had fair trade coffee, right?
Sure.
And have you ever seen Zizek's criticism of this notion of fair trade, right?
I can start to imagine it.
you can't imagine it, right? It's conscious consumerism without guilt. Mm. So there's the sense in which we recognize that as consumers – we are causing the deforestation of the third world. And, oh, now coconut oil is hot, right? So instead of diversity of crops, these farmers in these far-flung regions are going to be encouraged to this. So we assuage our bad conscience about being consumers by coming up with this story that somehow, oh, well, you know, the farmers that I buy my local Austin Rudamaya coffee, and the farmers that they buy beans from are being paid a fair wage. They're not being exploited by some giant corporation. And they're doing the roasting here, which means they're employing people here and stimulating the local economy, right? All of which is to say that it's a maneuver to try to make me feel better about the fact that I still just want my fucking coffee. And I want to feel good about the fact that I know that I'm a consumer. Underneath that is this notion that I recognize that resources are limited and that my very existence in the first world in the United States, with all the energy that I use and the water that I consume and all of this, is really an imposition on somebody else in the world. I should say my very existence as a consumer is somehow implicated in Bangladeshi textile factories and these kinds of things. And so I think there is a very real and practical sense of this notion of guilt for my existence. But to me, it makes sense much more in this consumer or in the capitalist framework than it does just kind of generally, like he brings up. Now, this resonates with me personally, but I think that has more to do with the pathology of my own psychological makeup based on how I was raised than anything else. I'm probably much more non-intentional and passive than I am intentional and rational. But I get Marx's criticism that he has no phenomenological access to this experience, which is what I take you to be saying.
Well, let's get into the face stuff, because that's sort of the phenomenology, right?
Yep.
Not that it's going to make it even more intuitively plausible, but it might explain some things.
The proximity of the other is the face's meaning, and it means from the very start in a way that goes beyond those plastic forms which forever try to cover the face like a mask of their presence to perception. But always the face shows through these forms, prior to any particular expression and beneath all particular expressions, which cover over and protect with an immediately adopted face or countenance, there is the nakedness and destitution of the expression as such. That is to say, extreme exposure, defenseless, vulnerability itself.
So in other words, all the different masks he's talking about, the particular expressions, smiling, any other effective expression on the face, there's something underneath all that, which is the expression of old vulnerability, which apparently, so that's sort of like the pre-reflective element that's always there in the face. So the layer, you may have the layers of effective expression, but at the very bottom, it's vulnerability, and that's what we confront in the other.
And right here, we get a point of contrast with Buber, where the I-thou experience has to be some kind of mutual gazing into each other's eyes, and it seems like you have to both be in a certain mindset to really appreciate each other as people, as opposed to treating each other like objects, having the I-it relationship. But here, it doesn't matter what kind of ordinary son of a bitch the other person is. They don't have to be looking at you with sympathy, with a desire to connect. Any expression, even a hard-ass expression, even a nauseous expression, you can see the vulnerability in that, and that is enough to get you ethically obligated toward them.
Yeah, even though we often block that out, right?
Yeah.
If we're thinking of this psychologically. And then there's also, through that, there's this consciousness of our, well, of mortality in general, I guess. So at the end of that paragraph, from the beginning, there is a face-to-face steadfast in its exposure to invisible death, to a mysterious forsakenness, beyond the visibility of whatever is unveiled, and prior to any knowledge about death, mortality lies in the other. So this experience of the other's vulnerability is our first experience of mortality.
So as soon as a baby encounters its mother's face, then it gets the idea, that the mom's going to die.
I don't think so. I mean, he's not necessarily.
Okay.
We don't have to pinpoint him at any stage of development. You know, it's just on the way to self, it has to occur somewhere on the way to self-consciousness.
Okay. You get ethics. So the baby doesn't necessarily have the ethics.
No, they definitely don't.
As soon as you get sophisticated enough to really have a sense of self, then you get the ethics in the process.
Yeah,
that.
By the age of three, they're struggling. They're trying to rein in their monstrousness before they get big and strong enough to hurt people with it.
And the fact that I said you get the ethics, it doesn't mean you have an understanding of ethical rules or that
right.
You have an ethical code or something. It's that there is a call to you that you can ignore, of course, but you have the ethics in that sense that you hear the call.
Yeah. It's similar to a virtue ethicist saying that you have that telos, or to a Kantian saying, well, that's what you will rationally, even if you deviate from it, right? Or that's the law that you've laid down for yourself, even if you actually deviate from it. So there's something in us that sets us up with the ethical code or something like that, regardless of whether we follow through. But in this case, we get this psychological sounding phenomenology to it.
Yeah, I would put this more in the case like where people justify, you've heard the call of Jesus. You can choose to ignore it, but you've all heard it. Like, it's about as epistemically dubious as that, as in my opinion. But Seth, do you want to react to
The key words that came up during what you just read, vulnerability and mortality. He's trying to make the point of saying, and this shows up again in the other essay, trying to tie it back, that for Heidegger, the experience of death is something that you take on from that position as subject. Granted, these are not Heideggerian terms. He wouldn't use the term subject, consciousness, all that stuff. But the idea is that you encounter death from the position of this self-consciousness, and it's a recognition of the possibility of the end, the impossibility of possibility, the point at which this thing that you are projecting out into the future will cease to be. And that movement is something that you take on conceptually through your understanding, and it's what allows you to have an authentic existence. Now, there's nothing moral about this movement in Heidegger. Its authenticity here means being elevated out of the they, the commonality, the masses. What I think Levinas is trying to do here is to say the experience of mortality, the notion of death, doesn't come post facto in the understanding where you come to a rational understanding of death. It comes in this vulnerable exchange with the other in the face-to-face, where that vulnerability is somehow a recognition, right? It's responsibility of my existence vis-a-vis the other's existence, but it's a recognition that other's existence could potentially end, and so could mine. And so he's trying to tie the relationship, the recognition of mortality, my own mortality, to the mortality of the other. Whereas with Heidegger, the notion of death and this anxiety that you have being towards death is completely in the understanding, and so it's part of wrapped up in that solitude. Levinas, it's important to him to tie it to the other because he's trying to get outside of that solipsistic understanding.
Yeah, he says it's as if I had to answer for the other's death even before being. And then he talks of a guiltless responsibility and a responsibility stemming from a time before my freedom. So again, this sort of gets us to an ethics that is not tied in the typical existentialist way to freedom and is grounded before that. But it might help, I don't know, there's this paragraph where he talks about mortality, I think is might be worth reading. It's not relevant, but,
no,
but in its expression, in its mortality, the face before me summons me, calls for me, begs for me, as if the invisible death that must be faced by the other, pure otherness, separated in some way from any whole, were my business. It is as if that invisible death, ignored by the other, whom already it concerns by the nakedness of its face, were already regarding me prior to confronting me, and becoming the death that stares me in the face. And skipping down a little bit, the other becomes my neighbor precisely through the way the face summons me, calls for me, begs for me, and in doing so recalls my responsibility and calls me into question. And then in the following paragraphs, we get this whole idea of a kind of being responsible before we are even beings in a way. We're constituted by this guiltless responsibility. It's not that we become beings with freedom and then we get our ethical obligations. It's they constitute us in a sense as beings. So responsibility for my neighbor dates from before my freedom in an immemorial past, an unrepresentable past that was never present and is more ancient than consciousness of a responsibility for my neighbor.
Yeah. And so I suppose even though this is how genetically it happens, if we were to encounter an alien race that has intelligence and compassion and all these things, but they don't happen to have faces.
I knew this objection was going to come up.
You know, that for Kant, as long as it's a rational being, then you have to respect it and treat it. But if we're really going to take him seriously, that it's the other is the neighbor precisely through the way the face summons me. I mean, should we really, It seems like Levinas likes us to take him literally.
Yeah, well, I think he does in some sense want to take him literally, although his prose is so difficult to comprehend. But let me say this. This right now is a theme about particularity, which is particularly Judaic. We've talked about this before, probably years ago, but the priority of the particular over the universal, or the individual over the abstracted concept. And this is definitely part of what's going on here, is that he doesn't mean the face in an abstract sense. We do have the capital O other, but he is talking about a particular experience, the experience of actually looking another individual in the face. This is not just a metaphor.
Well,
and that's a really important point.
Well, if we were thinking about this psychologically and developmentally, obviously we know that you don't need faces and you don't need eyesight to develop moral sentiments. So in a way, I want to not take it literally, right?
Okay, how about this? He's talking about a specific encounter with a particular individual. You can use the term face and eyes and whatever. This is just my opinion.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you, yeah.
That he wants you to consider a particular individual in front of you.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, if they didn't have a face, or I couldn't see, I didn't have eyes,
screw
I think
those
we'd
people
still
over
be,
the internet.
We'd still be fine. All the face stuff would still happen internal psychologically, but yeah.
Have you guys seen this documentary called The Artist is Present, Maria Abramovich?
Why'd that name sound so familiar?
She's a performance artist, and she did I want to say it was in New York at MoMA or one of the museums in New York, where she just sat in a chair, and people who visiting the museum could come and sit across from her in a chair, and they had to look her in the eyes, and she just stared. And they made a documentary about this. And it's amazing how difficult it is for people to engage with her, like literally face to face, and how it's a heroic personal act on her part to be present like that for all these different people as they filtered through for like hours at a time. And it's what I was put in mind of as we hit this section. And I'd recommend you guys take a look at it and our listeners.
Yeah, Danto wrote an article on that. I remember reading at the time that she was doing that. Kind of relatedly, some of this made me think of a service or a hookup spot or something, you know, that it's like an Ashley Madison or something, but not for sex, just for like, just gazing into each other's eyes. Like that's the whole benefit. I wonder if there's a market for that.
Well, this is one of the reasons why psychoanalysts actually prefer their patients to lie on the couch.
They don't want to look them in the face?
It's exhausting. I have a lot of therapist friends, and it's it makes your job. If you're sitting with patients for 8 hours a day, it's a lot more work because you have to do all the things that you do, you know, when you're face to face with someone. You have to make all those expressions and in response to their expressions. And it's harder to simply concentrate on what they're saying. And it's harder for the patient simply to free associate because they are monitoring you for approval or disapproval or things like that.
One of the reasons why we don't use video in this podcast.
Well, that and I don't want you guys to see me and all the faces.
Well, I don't have a face.
Faces I'm making. So.
I find when we do have the video on that I more or less ignore it, that I will look at it occasionally, but I do not, it's not the same as like having a person in the room with you and feeling the need. It'd be similar if we're all in the same room together, but we still like just have the convention that we're looking at our notes and, you know, occasionally looking at the other people. It's the fact that I'm not looking at you doesn't mean that I'm not listening and doesn't mean that I don't care what you're saying. You know, you'd have to have some settled things to not have to. Okay. I don't know if as a shrink, you can just say, we're going to be in a chair where I'm looking at you, but you just got to get used to the fact that I'm going to just be kind of staring off into space and looking at my notebook, and that's got to be okay with
you. It's not going to work.
That's a ground rule. If it looks like I'm asleep, that's just my way of deep listening. That's what I say to people who are cutting my hair or doing my teeth.
Shrinks do fall asleep.
I have a friend who's a therapist, but he works with the VA, so he sees a lot of current and ex-military people who he specializes in PTSD. And I have many a times had dinner with him after a day and he's wrung out. It's incredibly exhausting to do that kind of work and to be present for an individual like that for like 8 hours, you know, because the VA puts them through the grinder, right? They have this minimum number of cases and it's brutal.
Yeah, I have a friend up here who specialized in that. same thing, wartime.
Yeah.
PTSD. And yeah, it's very hard to do that, you know, only that for full time.
Hey, folks. Like many of you, I am always looking for ways to enrich my life with more knowledge and to become more wise. That is one of the inspirations why Mark West and I created Partially Examined Life, why we asked Dylan to join us, and we continue to do so 8 years later on down the road. But it's also a reason why I'm enjoying the Great Courses Plus, and I'd like for you to try it too. The Great Courses Plus offers a library of engaging online video lectures in many, many topics presented by award-winning professors like Robert Solomon from the University of Texas. He has a course running on the Great Courses Plus called Passions, Philosophy, and the Intelligence of Emotions. Now, it's a perfect time for us to be talking about the intelligence of emotions because we just finished our arc with Nussbaum on anger and forgiveness, and of course, Levinas's ethical first philosophy that uses Eros as a model for a transcendent ethical relation is a perfect fit. Solomon covers those topics, but goes much further to talk about cultural universals across emotions, how emotions function psychologically, and even to end on, fortunately, a happy note, talking about laughter and the role that emotions play both in music and spirituality. With the Great Courses Plus, you get unlimited access to learn about hundreds of topics across philosophy, religion, history, science, and you can stream the lectures anywhere at any time. You can start and resume from any of your devices. So listen, I know you're going to love the Great Courses like I do, and I want you to sign up because right now they're giving PEL listeners a special offer, a free month of unlimited access to all their lectures. You can start that free month now by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL. Hey folks, we have another sponsor for today, new to Partially Examined Life, and that is Gulf Breeze Recovery. For those suffering with an addiction problem who have unsuccessfully attended treatment, there is hope. The National Institute on Drug Abuse claims there is no single treatment option that is right for everyone, and that treatment should address the multiple needs of an individual and not just the drug use. Recovery should move beyond coping with addiction to helping people thrive. Gulf Breeze Recovery's Thrive program is a holistic non-12-step treatment system that not only treats the true underlying cause of the addiction, but also addresses the individual's physical, spiritual, and mental needs. Gulf Breeze Recovery helps people discover a fresh new outlook on life that enables them to be captains of their own ship. The waterfront facility is neat, clean, comfortable, offers private and semi-private rooms, a lighted fishing pier, and a large swimming pool overlooking the water. You can view the webcam, take a virtual tour, and get more information at gulfbreezerecovery.com or call 855-9-HOLISTIC-REHAB. Thanks to Gulf Breeze for sponsoring the show, and now back to the conversation.
Hey, before we get back to it, I have one more thing to announce, which is that we would like to harness you, our faithful listeners, in trying to let more people know about the Partially Examined Life. And the way we're going to do that is through motivating you to share the post for this episode that appears on our Facebook page. Now, that's not our Facebook group, the discussion group. I mean our Facebook page that just has posts from us. Now, within the next week, before episode 146 is posted, you go to that Facebook page, find the post that's stuck right at the top of that page for part one of this episode, episode 145, and share that post. Don't just like it. You need to share it. That's going to make a link to the post appear on your wall to declare to all your friends that you found this episode valuable. You want them to check it out. Now, for every single person that does that, we will send a link so you can listen to our old Heidegger Being in Time episode that keeps getting referenced on this thing. You'll notice that is one of the Behind the Firewall member-only episodes, episode 32. So if you go share this episode, you'll receive that episode without having to become a Partially Examined Life citizen. However, among all those who share the episode, we will have a drawing and will award a free one-month Partially Examined Life citizenship to a lucky individual so that person can hear not only the Heidegger episode, but all the other Behind the Firewall episodes for nothing. All right, thanks. Back to it.
Section 5.
Yeah, and we've already covered the first couple paragraphs of that. The third paragraph seems the first new thing. Fear for the other man's death is my fear, but it is in no way an individual's taking fright. It thus stands out against the admirable phenomenological blah, 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 blah.
Well, the point here is, and he goes on to say, all affectivity therefore has repercussions for my being for death. So it's, you know, what Seth was saying about this more solipsistic approach to being thrown into the world, right? And in all those conditions. Here, what you're thrown into is the face-to-face. And so my being for death, which I, in my very simple layperson's view, take as having something to do with defining the way you live in terms of your consciousness that you're going to die. And that's the ultimate end possibility by which I have to define all my possibilities that I call my projects. So that changes if I'm thinking now about, so he's saying all affectivity, the emotional expressions of others become part of what determines that for me. That is part of what I'm thrown into. Other people's bad moods. No.
Well, really, it's not other people's bad moods because it's
no matter what mood they have,
that's kind of like their face. It's kind of like the various faces they put on, their masks, but it's their very existence. There was a quote in one of the other, in the Time and the Other, that says something that's like, sociality is time itself. And that doesn't sound relevant because we haven't filled in the gap that, well, we've referred to it in an offhand way, but that at the same time, we need the notion of other people to have the notion of time at all. So this passivity is kind of, you know, we were talking about the passivity with regard to time. Regard to time and with regard to the other really amount to the same
thing. Yeah, that's because we don't get the future. To get an idea of the future, we need the other.
Yep. It's so primal, this reaction to the other. It's not that the fact that the other looks at us in a certain way that makes us react this way. It's the fact that the other kind of exists at all. And we have this face-to-face recognition of the other, that that's enough to get us everything, to get us the notion of temporality, to get us the notion of death, get us the notion of morality. The other doesn't have to do anything in particular.
They just have to sit there and look nice.
Not even that. But did we cover why it's in no way an individual's taking fright? It's not an individual because it's not a subjective thing that we are doing.
This is before we've become individuals.
Oh,
so
right.
It's my fear, but not an individual's fear in the sense of someone who's a subject. Yeah.
Would it be correct to say that it is a function of... So the way we talked in the Buber episode, which I just freshly re-listened to part of it, was that the fundamental thing is not the individual subject, but it is this, just like Heidegger is saying, that being in the world is fundamental. It's not me being, and then there's the world. It's being in the world is one thing. For Buber, it was the I and thou is one thing, and the individual gets abstracted away from that. Is that the same thing that's happening here? That before the I is created, before it would be an individual that takes fright, that we just have you and the face that you are contemplating are a really a fundamental ontological unit before the self even comes into being?
Yeah, I couldn't really tell.
Does that seem right?
I don't know if Seth has a...
Or is it just that it's a pre-reflective, non-positional self, passive experience?
Yeah, how you get into the ontology of it, is unclear to me. There's just this soup of sociality that the individual sort of crystallize out of.
Did we read the part about emotion in that paragraph? Emotion consists in being moved, being scared by something, overjoyed by something, saddened by something, but also in feeling joy or sadness for oneself. All affectivity, therefore, has repercussions for my being for death. Why? There is a double intentionality in the by and the for. And so there's a turning back on oneself and a return to anguish for oneself, for one's finitude, in the fear inspired by the wolf, an anguish for my death. Fear for the other man's death does not turn back into anguish for my death. It extends beyond the ontology of the Heideggerian Dasein and the good conscience of being in the sight of that being itself. There's ethical awareness and vigilance in this emotional unease. Certainly Heidegger's being for death marks, for this being, the end of his being in the sight of that being, as well as the scandal provoked by that ending. But in that ending, no scruple of being is awakened. So do we want to just say more about Heidegger's being unto death and how this is a rejection of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Heidegger's, it's the way in which our consciousness of the fact that we're going to die defines us if we're going to be authentic. We have to keep it in mind. Seth, what is the real answer?
No, you're right. The key point here is Heidegger's notion of anxiety before death or in front of death, about death, is that it's something that reflects back on myself. It's the way I inhabit my full authenticity as Dasein. And up until that point, and the reason why that's the case is in the Heideggerian ontology, I'm caught up in what is going on around me, the social. So people say I should do this. People say I should wear that. People say I should eat this and do that and think this and think that. And that's inauthentic. It's bad conscience, right? That I'm following what the dictates of society or of fashion or what have you. And for Heidegger, the only way to escape that is that you fully come to experience the anxiety that comes with recognizing that at some point there will be no future for you. You will inhabit no possibilities. Your death is yours and yours alone. It's the one thing in your entire existence that you can uniquely own. And I don't mean own in terms of possession, but there is more fanciful language around that. But essentially, it's the one thing that truly is your own and simultaneously is not at all anybody else's. So it's not something you get from anybody else. So if you come to terms with your anxiety about the fact that at some point you will cease to be, you can truly then begin to live an authentic life.
So I'll be less inclined to be a conformist. I mean, what is it? Is it that my awareness of death means that I'm going to do what's important to me and block out the pressures to conform? Like, if I wouldn't be so conformist if I knew what was at stake, is that the idea?
It's the possibility for that happening. It's not to say that you will or won't do it, but it is the precondition as far as Heidegger's concerned.
It is possible that you won't join the Nazi party, even though.
Yeah.
So Levinas is, difference here. He says awareness of death doesn't really awaken any scruple, as he puts it.
The awareness of my death doesn't.
Right.
What he says is fear for the other man's death does not turn back into anguish for my death. That your coming to recognition of mortality is a coming to recognition as a fear for the other person's death.
Right.
Namely, as possibly at your hands or by somehow in your responsibility. And that's the foundation of this ethics as first philosophy, not a recognition of your own death and not a kind of self-satisfying exploration of anxiety about your own death that somehow leads to an authentic existence.
It's anxiety about the other, in a way, comes first.
Yes.
And so that's part of what we're thrown into. I think that's the sort of how that alters that, this kind of the other and I'm putting it as the ethical demand that the other makes. That's probably not the best way to put it, but that's sort of basic, and that's part of what we are thrown into. It's not just this anxiety about ourselves.
So the next paragraph, this is the hidden human face behind perseverance in being.
Yeah.
Exclamation point.
Like, why does that one deserve an exclamation? You said a lot of interesting things already. Didn't need an exclamation point for
hidden
that.
Behind the affirmation. Yeah. He should just have exclamation points all over the place. Just make it like a Marvel comic from the 60s. Hidden behind the affirmation of being persisting analytically or animally in its being, and in which the ideal vigor of identity identifying and affirming and strengthening itself in the life of human individuals and in their struggle for vital existence, whether conscious or unconscious or rational, the miracle of the ego vindicated in the eyes of the neighbor, or the miracle of the ego which has gotten rid of the self and instead fears for the other, is thus like the suspension or epoche of the eternal and irreversible return of the identical to itself and of the intangible nature of its logical and ontological privilege.
Jesus, what a sentence.
I try to check my ontological privilege.
It almost is exactly what it means. Checking your privilege.
Suspension.
Assertion of privilege in the objectionable white privilege sense is an ontological privilege. I think the word is almost redundant.
So wait, let me read the next sentence and ask a question. What is suspended is its ideal priority, which wipes out all otherness by murder or by all-encompassing and totalizing thought.
One of those.
Or war and politics, which pass themselves off as the relation of the same to the other. So is this the point where Levinas is saying the phenomenological epoche is the move that suspends that privilege? It makes possible the suspension of that privilege so that you can get to this pre-intention. What is he saying here?
Yeah. This sounds like de Beauvoir here and rejection of the serious, right? What is suspended is its ideal priority. Well, actually, in this case, the ideal priority is of the ego, right? So it's a little different. Yeah.
Yes. So that is what you were taking seriously. you were taking as me, 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 the self. That is the fundamental thing and everything refers to it. And the epoche means you're suspending it. You're setting that. You're just kind of putting it on a hold. Yes, it's still there, something that's operating in consciousness. You know, this sounds very much like a Buddhist practice here, suspending the ego and trying to see what emerges from that. But Levinas would criticize the Buddhist there because that still sounds like it's something that you're doing by yourself. But maybe the Buddhist connection is, oh, it's compassion. It's something connected to the other that is supposed to give rise to this, right? Compassion can lead to the epoche.
Yeah, it's not compassion, he will say in the other essays. I think he explicitly rejects that. Yeah.
Ah. Mm-hmm. Because compassion would, again, rely on some property of the person in particular.
So it's in time and the other, and it's basically, he calls it sympathy. So it's not like we're related to the other, like they're another version of myself and that we participate in this common existence and that they sort of resemble me and I sympathize with them because my relationship is with the mystery. The other's being is constituted entirely by its alterity. So it can't be sympathy. That's not the fundamental relationship.
I'm just not sure that compassion entails sympathy. That's normally, I guess, the way we think of it, but I brought it up in a Buddhist context and supposedly the enlightened Buddha who has compassion, right? Even though he's not subject to all those awful illusions of self.
I mean, he says explicitly that it's not that I'm putting myself in the other person's place. I mean, he's definitely talking about compassion in that other essay. It's not like he's not talking about compassion as a moral sentiment. That's not what the face-to-face is. At least in my reading of the other essays. That's one of the what I thought was really interesting about it.
I mean, it sounds like the emphasis on vulnerability and the actual emotion that you would feel in light of vulnerability, isn't that compassion?
Well, so when you talk about like you have a newborn baby that you bring home, it's completely vulnerable, right? It can't take care of itself. It can't feed itself. It has no self-motive. It has no motive power. Would you say that your desire to take care of that baby and to protect it and whatever is out of compassion?
Yeah, that's a good point. Even though I think the other part we should look at is that we're talking about something pre-reflective, remember? So whatever this comportment mm-hmm. is towards the other, it's not necessarily, I think, something that we're going to be familiar with at the level of the day-to-day affectivity, the day-to-day kinds of thoughts and feelings we have. So that's why compassion may not be, or sympathy may not be the right word. But Seth, I think that's a really good point because it brings into play this sort of, you know, I think some of what he's talking about with eros, right?
Yes.
The relationship to the mystery is fundamentally erotic. It's about libido or about love, which is the same, I think, as the relationship to the infant.
Do we want to move off into that essay or do we want to keep charging through here?
Well, I think there's at least one other point to be made here.
Okay.
The next paragraph on page 85. The ego is the very crisis of the being of a being. In the human domain, a crisis of being, not because the sense of this verb might still need to be understood, blah, 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 but because I begin to ask myself if my being is justified, if the Da of my Dasein is not already the usurpation of somebody else's place. This question has no need of a theoretical reply in the form of new information. Rather, it appeals to responsibility, which is not a practical stopgap measure designed to console knowledge in its failure to match being. This responsibility does not deny knowledge, the ability to comprehend and grasp. Instead, it is the excellence of ethical proximity in its sociality and its love without concupiscence. I did look up that word, I have to admit, when I was reading this. The human is the return to the interiority of non-intentional consciousness, to bad conscience, to its capacity to fear injustice more than death, to prefer to suffer than to commit injustice, and to prefer that which justifies being over that which assures it.
So it's funny that the way that this talk of respect for the other, the way that it comes up in current political consciousness is to sort of recognizing the other as other means that you can't understand it. Whereas he's saying this responsibility, that, you know, the result of this recognizing the other as other does not deny knowledge the ability to comprehend and grasp. It just is an appeal to responsibility. So it actually is not really relevant to knowledge at all.
Well, we don't cease to have intentionality just because of all this stuff. Sorry, am I misunderstanding?
Maybe. I was trying to say that, you know, so you might say, hey, you white people, you don't understand us. We are radically other as compared to you. And so don't pretend to put your white gaze over everything and eat us in an aggressive way of knowledge. Recognize us in our otherness as something that exceeds your grasp. And that is the sort of respectful, politically correct way. In fact, not just among groups, of course, but for every single individual to recognize that the other person. So it really does have a very specific epistemic result. Whereas here he's saying it doesn't. The responsibility does not deny knowledge its ability to comprehend and grasp.
I was just thinking he meant that generally. It's not like we cease to be knowing, grasping, intentional beings. Or in other words, it's not like the responsibility created by all of this means that we have to stop being scientists or we have to stop being knowledge seekers and experts and technicians. It's just that
we can't.
We also have this other thing going on. So,
okay. It could be compatible with limits in knowledge due to otherness, which is certainly implied by many other things in the text. If the other is primarily mystery,
right,
then yeah, that implies something epistemic.
And this would be towards everyone, you know, love without concupiscence. Whatever is ethical between us is not a matter of knowledge and grasping. And even, I would argue, empathy. And I think he's got a point. It's something I've given a lot of thought to recently. Not that we need to go down that. But I think this question of whether morality is like that, empathy is a proper grounds for morality, I think Kant would say no. And I think, as far as I can tell, Levinas would say no.
So we're finally to the last section, which is really just a recap, right?
Yeah.
To be or not to be. Is that the question? Is that the first and final question? Does being human consist in forcing oneself to be? And does the understanding of the meaning of being, the semantics of the verb to be, represent the first philosophy required by a consciousness which from the first would be knowledge and representation, conserving its assurance in being for death, asserting itself as the lucidity of a thought, thinking itself right through, even unto death, in which even in its finitude, already or still an unquestioned bad conscience as regards its right to be. This is all freaking one sentence. Is either anguished or heroic in the precariousness of its finitude?
No.
No. Or does the first question arise in the bad conscience, an instability which is different from that threatened by my death and my suffering? It poses the question of my right to be, which is already my responsibility for the death of the other, interrupting the carefree spontaneity of my naive perseverance. So there you go. That's just pure recap.
The question par excellence, or the question of philosophy, is not why being rather than nothing, but how being justifies itself.
So the way that that last thing is just put is directly against Heidegger. Heidegger thought we actually, the semantics, oh, people have neglected the question of being. They don't ask the question of being.
That is correct.
Well, that's a thing you should worry about.
And that's exactly the tone of voice that Heidegger used. When
yes.
For Levinas, there's a question more fundamental than being. Pre-being?
Prior.
Daycare for being, where we learn to be nice to others. But it comes before we are beings. That's the main point, is that, you know, comes before reflectivity at that low a level our ethical comportment is.
All right. So to kind of wrap up here, what do you think so far? How does this measure up against, say, Simone de Beauvoir's existentialist defense of why ethics has to be fundamental? Which did you find more convincing? Either of them?
Can I say both? Because that's always my answer.
Well, tell more.
Well, the difference, and I think we've gotten at that at various places in this conversation, is that for de Beauvoir, and I think for Sartre and existentialism in general, it's more about you ground the ethical and the freedom of the subject. Freedom is something he associates with self-consciousness and what he calls good conscience and being an active objectifier and knower and things like that. And I think the point here is that these ethical obligations, I don't know if that's exactly the right word, but they arise before all of that. They arise prior to our being self-conscious, reflective beings. And in a way, they help constitute us as such. And in some ways, it does sound Hegelian, right? The sense in which we, to be self-conscious beings, we rely on the consciousness or the recognition of others. Here, it's to be ethical beings, we rely on some sort of fundamental relationship to the other. And we can't really, even though Kant, for instance, tries to relate freedom and our relationship to the other, that is the idea that we should treat people as ends in themselves. You may think that's a tenuous connection and that to really establish some sort of genuine obligation to another, it sort of has to be built into the ontology from the very beginning. You can't just start out with these separate, isolated individuals and then generate some sort of legitimate ethical relationship between them. It has to constitute them in some sense.
Yeah, I just think that I wouldn't describe Simone de Beauvoir's solution as starting with isolated individuals and then they have to be connected in some sense, because I feel like the fact that as soon as you're making decisions at all, you're exerting your freedom, even doing this for Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir pre-reflectively, you're doing this before you even think about, like, I'm making a decision. Like, you're just doing it. So the very act of acting involves, according to its internal logic, obligation to the other. That's pretty damn early. And I'm not sure that it's any earlier than Levinas.
Yeah. So she comes up with the idea that we have to will the freedom of others, but that's only because we can't will our own freedom without doing that. To will our own freedom, we have to be able to will it indeterminately, and we can't do that unless we can rely on the freedom of others. By the way, it's just a rehash of Kant, but the idea of universalizing maxims and not giving us a world which contradicts our aims. And yeah, so that sounds kind of the same sort of grounding of ethics in a person's ego or almost even their own particular interests, as opposed to just saying, no, there's the fundamental obligation and I don't have to justify that in terms of me willing my own freedom, for instance. I already have it set up from the very beginning before I'm free or an ego or any of that stuff.
It also is, we haven't said really what this obligation to other people involves for Levinas. I mean, it's really pretty extreme. It's like complete responsibility for the other person. Am I my brother's keeper? Yes.
He calls it a guilt-free responsibility. So that's why I use the word obligation hesitantly, because it's almost proto-ethical, right? This talk of guilt-free responsibility. It's responsibility. It's a weird thing to say that we're responsible even before we are reflective beings, right? We usually associate responsibility with reason and being reflective. So it would take a lot more to say, how can there be this guilt-free responsibility even before we are beings?
I'll point out again that, like, for example, he uses the term neighbor. There are callbacks to very traditional biblical notions of responsibility and so forth. That one of the things I really liked about de Beauvoir's account was her very, very comprehensive enumeration of psychological states or responses. So ways in which you could try to be responsible and free and somehow not be.
Or evade responsibility, right?
Yeah. You think that you are taking responsibility, but you're actually not for one reason or another. What I like about Levinas is I can't help but read him in the context of Heidegger. And so, you know, on the one hand, Heidegger set a stake in the ground and there were a bunch of people that responded to him. You had Merleau-Ponty, because the criticism was, well, Heidegger forgets the body. So Merleau-Ponty comes along and he brings in the body. And Heidegger forgets the other. So you have Sartre responding to that. But I think Levinas can be read as, well, Heidegger forgets the ethical somehow. And if you take seriously the idea that Levinas is addressing this gap, which is not addressed in Heidegger, and more importantly, is not addressed by the existentialists, if you don't think of Levinas as an existentialist, then you take a different view of what his project is about. And he's very explicit in here about how he's not talking about freedom. He doesn't mention Sartre, does he, in anything that we read?
I believe he does, but there was doubt that he'd actually read Being Nothingness in, even though it came out before this.
Well, Transcendence of the Ego would be the non-positional. That's all he would need for the non-positional stuff.
Yes, he was aware of that and of the Imagination book.
But there's this weird sense in which Levinas claims to be faithful to phenomenology. We'd have to read Totality and Infinity to see if he's actually doing something like what Heidegger is doing. But he talks a lot, you know, just as much about Husserl. And so I really don't see Levinas as an existentialist, and particularly as the Jewish stuff comes up and sort of weaves its way into these things, I think there's some real tension there.
Yeah, so I thought this was really, really fantastic, actually.
Were you not expecting it?
Well, I expected it just to be hard, and I didn't know whether I was going to be able to get something out of it in the time I had. But I found this is one of those things where the first reading is like, oh man, this is going to be a rough one. And then the second reading is actually, wow, this actually makes some sense.
Well, and the more I read about him and just the different readings fed into each other to just make it mutually easier to understand any given point. Whereas initially it would just seem like word salad and like, oh no, this is just a different way of kind of making the same point over and over again.
But some of the stuff that we'll talk about, we may talk about next time.
So next time we've decided we're going to continue on the same set of readings. We're basically done with Ethics as First Philosophy, but we're going to read all of The Time and the Other, and not just the second half from 1948. So why don't you just get that and read along with us?
I like that one even better. The stuff about Eros and Shakespeare and all the rest of it. Just very, very thought-provoking and interesting. I have to say I'm like moved by it just at that basic level.
I thought you would like it when he said, sometimes I think that all of philosophy is just a ruination on Shakespeare.
Yeah, I did enjoy that.
Mark, you just said something about word salad. One thing I do remember is that in Totality and Infinity, it's very much like Heidegger in that sense where he's like inventing a language and a way of talking and it's brutal. But these essays are extremely coherent. And I think his chain of reasoning is very clear. I mean, you may not agree with every assertion, but the language is very graspable. And I think his process of moving from point to point is logical and coherent. And I think that's one of the things that I appreciate is that I think these were, you know, lectures, right? No, this one was published, but Time and the Other, some of these, I think, was part of a lecture.
Yep, our four lectures, yep.
And, you know, maybe this is a good lesson for us. Every time we read somebody's lectures, we have a better go of it than when we try to read the masterwork. So maybe we ought to keep that in mind going forward. Anyway, I'm glad you guys enjoyed it. Well, Wes, anyway. Mark hasn't expressed an opinion.
Mark seemed to enjoy it.
I went in waves. When I started it, I was like, yeah, I'm getting this. Let's read more. Let's read a lot. Then I didn't read for a few days. And when the time was approaching for the episode, then I felt like, oh my God, I'm not even going to get through the one essay. This is terrible. But then I got in the groove and like, you know, by the end I was feeling like, oh no, I want to read three more essays. I want to read as much of them as I can. I want to get, that was what I was afraid, that this was going to be such a difficult text. They were going to read our, you know, 12-page article, and that's all we are going to get. And like, what, that we understand Levinas now? Like, I just seemed like it would be unsatisfying. But the way it turned out, the way we approached it with the multiple essays and looking at secondary literature, I feel better about it.
Well, what did you guys look at? I didn't find the Stanford article that helpful. It was kind of written in its own continental jargon. I don't know.
I didn't love the Stanford. I found two other secondary essays that I looked at just on Ethics as First Philosophy, one of which was almost like an outline, and that helped me understand the structure of the argument. But yeah, I didn't find the Stanford very helpful either.
Well, the intro of the Levinas Reader, and then, like I said, I found the Time and the Other standalone version, and that had a long intro that not only explained Time and the Other, but gave background on his thought in general. Well, we hope everybody enjoyed this and the return of Seth and likes it so much that they will go and become Partially Examined Life citizens or just donate heaps of cash to fund our drug habits. I think it's the fact that they don't see our faces, that they don't feel like immediately obligated to give us money. Don't you think that's the issue? If we had a video podcast, they would be face to face.
Possibly.
Or if we were touring, we need to do that.
Well, I would be happy to if people just spread the word. Got all everybody else to listen to. You don't have to give us money either.
All right. How about this? As soon as somebody goes to our website, then like we have a thing, you know how when you're at some sites, some customer service window opens and says, hey, can I help you with something? Like we have to have a video window of one of us live. We have to man it between us at all times. We'll just go and like, hey, I see you're enjoying the site. Do you want to give us money?
Hi, I'm Wes from the Partially Examined Life. I'd like to talk to you for a few moments. About my lack of an income.
Do you guys have a great stock photo of you with like a little headset on in a call center?
Right, exactly.
It's always like some woman in a suit, a nice big smile, usually a brunette.
Can I assist you with the giving of money to us?
Hey, Brett. I see you're nearby.
That's a different thing.
Why don't we hook up for some philosophical face to face.
Yeah, Mark, that's, you're definitely not going to be in the customer service chat room. Yeah.
We're not going to start running a philosophy live webcam. Some version of that might be interesting. Just a short, keep the Eros to a minimum, that's all.
Sublimated, highly sublimated in legal ways.
Yeah.
Hey, you can get immediate response from somebody if you go post to our Facebook group, because there's always people who will respond to whatever you post.
That's probably not friendly.
Probably smart or obnoxious. There are many supportive people. It's an ecosystem. It's awesome. And follow us on Twitter. Like our Facebook page, which is different than the Facebook group. Join our LinkedIn group. Do all those things. Thanks, everybody, and good night.
Good night.
Good night. For those who have attended addiction treatment without success, there is hope. The National Institute on Drug Abuse claims there is no single treatment option that is right for everyone. Gulf Breeze Recovery is a non-12-step holistic treatment facility that is successful in helping people break free from the addictive lifestyle. Visit gulfbreezerecovery.com or call 855-6-HOLISTIC-REHAB. Without